Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
getting on to epic episode 31 of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen. A really big tome. We're nearing on the edge of page 500, the page 498, and we've done sort of music, I suppose music, opera, or opera music, poetry, literature. So I can well imagine why my podcast audience, who must be scientists, go, "Oh my God, what the heck is this all about?" And for me, it's just sort of educational, just to read through it, to hack your way through it, and sort of form views about these people who love their poetry and stuff like that, having a bit more sanguine view, saying that the operas are a bit like DC Comics with classical music, and wouldn't interest audiences at the moment. The legends are okay. It's sort of several layers of introversion, cultural introversion going forward. Again, the literature, reading the literature is fascinating, but really, that sounds like D.H. Lawrence, sounds a lot of soft porn. I can't see why it's soft porn, but explores the brain of it all. It's sort of voyeuristic, psycho-voyeuristic stuff. Now we're up to his chapter 28. So you can remember I did a double chapter and two an introduction, and there's a floating chapter at the start, which I sort of can remember a long time ago. And there's things where I've dipped in my head. Schopenhauer is one person who I think is worth exploring as a seed philosopher. Like there's Leibniz and Parmenides, who are philosophers that people don't hear of but are seminal in going through. So as usual, there are two quotes at the start. So the title of this is Rising Star of Politics. Richard Nixon and Peter Morgan's play Frost/Nixon. Oh, okay, it's a play. If we allow ourselves a glimpse into the shadowy place we call our soul, isn't that why we're here now, the two of us, looking for a way back into the sun? Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Anders and Alexander Dubek welcoming the Velvet Revolution in an address to the crowds of Wenceslas Square in 1989. Okay, so this is the Polish one. The light was here before. Why should it be dark again? We had the morning. We must now act as though the light has come again. Okay, politics and light. Well, there you go. It's going to be a rough one. Okay. During his time at Yale, George W. Bush received 1D in astronomy. On his being elected president, the following tale went around. One day, keen to improve his standing in the polls, he told advisers his new idea. We'll land on the sun. It was gently pointed out the sun is awfully hot. The president considered this information no problem and says, we'll land at night. The only joke, this joke did not start with Bush. A decade earlier, was told about Mikhail Gorbachev, and before that, Nikita Khrushchev. Jokes combining the sun and the politician are unsurprisingly thin on the ground, but award-winning German film, The Lives of Others, successfully recycles one made the rounds of the old East Germany. In the film, a junior official ill-advised tells his superior officer the following tale, for which he is later demoted. There is no such thing as a harmless joke. Under Honecker, who led the GDR from 71 to 89, wakes up and throws open the door and welcomes the rising sun with a hearty good morning. Good morning, dear Eric, the sun replies. After lunch, he greets the sun again. Good day, dear Eric, he replies. At bedtime, he bids the sun good night. Screw you, Eric, it answers. I'm in the West now. The political cartoonists have so pickled up on the sun to make their points. Ralph Steadman, for instance, records his efforts during Ted Heath's election campaign against Arnold Wilson in 1970. I followed the desert landscape, showing the sun burning down the figurehead of Edward Heath, dying of thirst. In the sun was written, a better tomorrow. the foolish, and foolishly I thought that would nail him. I didn't, of course, because he won. Sibbon followed that with another landscape called Early Morning Scene, showing Heath in pyjamas watching the sun come up with Harold Wilson's face on it. Well, okay, so this is politics and the sun. Throughout history, the sun has been appropriated for political or religio-political effect. Hardly a generation has failed to provide. There's interesting solar energy and stuff like that. In modern times, Sri Lanka has witnessed the rise of the leader of the liberation Tigers, who styles himself as a solar deity. Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path, a terrorist afoot in the Peruvian Communist Party, was set up in the early 90s by a Scorpius professor of philosophy who had to keep out of the sun for health reasons, while Louis XIV was the most extravagant, conscripting the sun. The star lived on after the French Revolution as a potent symbol of the new social order, as well as the work of a radical aristocrat, Constantin François de Chassombeuf, Comte de Volney, a member of the new National Constituent Assembly. In Les Ruins, aux Méditations sur la Révolution des Empires, part novel and part tract, de Volney urged his readers to replace the remnants of decayed civilization with a world order reasoned and equality whose predominant symbol would not be Christ but the sun. The work was banned from France, guaranteeing a cult status in numerous foreign editions. When, in 1792, an anonymous translation was published in Britain, 35 Anglican prelates condemned it. No less a figure than Thomas Jefferson, who had befriended Volney while in France, translated the first 20 chapters for an American edition, only to lose his nerve and ask that the manuscript be burned. That's pretty amazing. The book, in several volumes, charges that Christianity had purloined solar beliefs and urges a return to the sun as a prime symbol of self-determination, ideas that would find their way back into a wide range of works. In the 19th century, many artists and thinkers inspired by the Romantic movement and the rise of nationalism claimed that the man would achieve his ultimate fulfillment by breaking free from the confines of religion. In Britain, as the sun as God theory became a staple of radical pantheism, and the solar nature of all deities was preached up and down the country. The history of the sun is the history of Jesus Christ, declared a typical firebrand Geoffrey Higgins, 1772 to 1833, by which he did not mean the sun equaled Christ, but rather Christianity had appropriated the solar symbolism. By rejecting that second faith, human beings could rediscover the most value of themselves. My Godfather. In the last quarter of that century, no one was more influential, Darwin accepted, than the great philologist-turned-philosopher, Friedrich Nietzsche, who died in 1844 to 1900. In the winter of 1876-7, then a sickly scholar of 32, travelled to Sorrento, south of Naples, where essential culture inspired him to put the human body at the centre of his thinking. I shook off 9 years of moss, he enthused, after visiting a cave that housed a relief portraying Mithras, the Persian sun god. Mithraism, from the Persian light of day, is a recent term. Antiquity, its Roman adherents referred to their religion as the secret doctrines of the Persians. The cult reaches Rome around the 1st century AD, and with its apogee in the 4th, finding particular support amongst soldiers. Ceremonies centred on Mithraism and adapted natural cave or imitation arranged as an image of the universe. Isn't that beautiful? Oh, the faithful were divided into 7 ranks, the 6th of which was that of Helodomus, or Sun Courier. The cult connected strongly with the sun, whose passage from the solstice to solstice was clearly paralleled in the soul's journey from existence briefly to the body and beyond to the afterlife. However, Mithraism quickly declined as Christianity began to assimilate the pagan deities. Apollo, the sun god, was seen as a precursor to Christ, while Apollo, the bringer of a sudden illumination, was transformed into the Holy Spirit. Well, there you go. Isn't that amazing? I found that amazing. During and after his time in Italy, he would write poems praising the sun as his lover. In Ecce Homo, this is Nietzsche poems. I wonder what they're like. In Ecce Homo, his last book before insanity overtook him, he writes, on this perfect day when everything was ripening and not only the grape turns brown, the eye of the sun just fell upon life. I look back, I look forward, I never saw so many good things at once. By the time he wrote The Gay Science in 1882, Nietzsche was arguing that the sunrise and the culmination of the zenith he employed as symbols for what man must become. This is a little disingenuous since his micrograms often forced him to hide away in the shadows. In Thus Spoke Zarathustra, that's amazing, he introduced the Übermensch, the superman, who has attained self-mastery, self-direction, all of which he is linked to the sun. These books were in part general movements of artists, musicians, and writers and who lauded the sun's Nietzsche's contemporary, the painter Udvard Munch, you know, his famous, you know, Munchianism, I love him, in 1863 to 1944, making a vital contribution. A member of the radical naturalist movement in his native Christiania, as Oslo was then known, well, really. He was invited in 1892 to mount an exhibition in Berlin and remained there for 3 years. His friends included Herbert Gibson, whose portrait he painted on several occasions, the first time in 1897, as a poster for the production of John Gabriel's Borkman. Playwright's powerful head dominates the picture while the light of the lighthouse casts its beam into space. The symbolism is forthright. Rizrat is a light-bearer, irradiating hidden realms of human experience. Munch also completed a series of sketches for ghosts, whose protagonist, the painter Oswald Arvig, yearns for a life yet lies under the fatal curse of inherited syphilis. Oh dear. Munch, a fellow sufferer, they all suffered syphilis. My God. So that's Nietzsche, Munch, the whole lot. How did they get it? A fellow sufferer saw his own feelings reflected in Oswald, a yearning for light and redemption. Heard Oswald's cry, "Give me the sun," a voice, his own eternal spirit. He described his painting, Spring, as craving for the mortally ill person for the light and warmth of the life of the sun. In Spring, the sunshine in the window, my godfather, it was Oswald's sun. By the time he had come to believe he was that his art should aspire to the heaven of the sun realm. So, my God, so there's politics and philosophy is sun-based. My God, you wouldn't have believed. While in Berlin, he also met a leading German interpreter of Nietzsche and in 1905-6 painted the great man's demonic sister Elizabeth. He collaborated, demonic sister Elizabeth, my God, collaborated with another friend and Nietzsche intoxicated August Strindberg on a series of paintings and poems that took over an entire issue of the magazine of Quickborn. That was devoted to glorifying the sun. Strindberg even bragged about having exchanged books with the philosopher. Nietzsche has shot such a monstrous load of semen into the spiritual life that I feel I have the belly of a whore. Nietzsche is my spouse. Oh my God. It's this type of stuff. It's like, I really, quite honestly think, set against, you know, I think there was so much experimentation that we have selected one aspect, which is the quantum physics and the physics coming through, but there's all this other mad stuff going on at the same. In 1909, Munch was commissioned to paint a cycle of 11 murals for the University of Oslo's Festival Hall. His first idea, Mountain of Mankind, an image taken directly from Thus Spoke Zarathustra, was rejected, so he replaced it with a monumental The Sun, also inspired by Nietzsche, in which the main painting was flanked by panels showing how the sun burns at the core in all forms of creativity. In an undated entry into his notebook, he elaborated, "One side of the hall, the rays become primitive invisible forces, the other intellectual impulses." Well, this is absolutely spandiferously amazing. I've got to get Schopenhauer, Nietzsche. Oh, okay. That sort of is sort of, it's like opera, and I think it's madness. Okay. The first pair of panels are overflowing with light. It travels into the bodies and then out of the crystal. There the light travels like X-rays. The other side of the painting, chemistry, represents the hidden energies, the workplace, the fire warmth. The other side of the sun sends its ray to even greater distances. This is amazing, these people. Which I think it's really interesting that I think we're disconnected with both things. We're disconnected with the actual thought of these people, thinking of these people. Also intensely disconnected with the mathematics developed at this time. People have replaced it with computers, and I don't think people are as mathematical at the moment. It took 7 years to finish and completed panels showing a Chusl-head creator god sitting before the sun into which he has given life. Munch's most recent biographer describes how the enormous burning globe is so sunlike that your eyes instinctively flinch away from the centre circle of light, just as you avoid directly looking at the original. On seeing the painting, Richard Strauss, author of his own homage to Nietzsche and tone poem, also sparked Zarathustra, exclaimed that it corresponds exactly to what he was trying to achieve in music. In 1893, Munch completed his masterpiece, The Scream, later recording how inspiration had struck him after the sunset walk up on a hill on the east of Oslo. The city's main slaughterhouse stood there, as did its madhouse, and the shrieks of the animals being butchered combined with the howling of insane and the cacophony of terrible to hear. Munch walked on across the bridge leading into the city. At that moment, the sun was setting. I felt a breath of melancholy. Suddenly the sky turned blood red. I stopped and leaned against the railing. I stood there, trembling with fear. I sensed a great infinite scream pass through nature. Well, that's beautiful. Isn't that beautiful to read this, that he did this walking at sunset and there was a slaughterhouse of man. This is beautiful stuff. Even though I know that people aren't really listening to it, it's just, what a great stuff. And if I can say, there's in terms of in my head I've got an intellectual view of patrolling. So if you have a base, you just always send out patrols to look at everything. Even if you don't think there's anything there, you just patrol and gather intelligence in that area. Now, I suppose not nowadays, you'd have satellite imagery and stuff like that, and drones to do it for you, and you fly over. But in earlier days, if you ever had a base, you would go out and patrol. And you obviously, they said, no, don't do this in cities. don't do this. But in hostile territory. And this is essentially what I'm doing. There's a book. I'll read it. I'll patrol it. And as you patrol, your thinking emerges and goes across the landscape. So to hear this is pretty amazing. It's impossible to know how much of an influence Munch's paintings of Nietzsche's books had on the general bubbling of the solar base philosophies at the time. But it has been considerable. Music also had its part to play, not just Wagner's operas and Strauss's tone poem, but also the erotic compositions of Alexander Schwabin, whose fourth and most famous symphony composed in 1905 was entitled Orgasmic Poem, in which the outset he saw its work as lust not just for the flesh but for the sun, telling a friend, "When you listen to it, look straight into the sun's eye." My God. Like Munch and Strindberg, Schwabin draws on Nietzsche and looks to this hero, to his third sonata directly for Superman. His fifth and last symphony, Prometheus, a poem of fire. I just have to remember this. Written between 1909 and 1910, also portrays a superhuman hero. Schwabin instructed the finale should open in a completely dark auditorium, gradually to the pervaded light as Prometheus' quest ends with the sun. Yeah, Prometheus, I just have to get in my head, Prometheus' sun, I thought that was where you cut the legs off. I must get this wrong in my head. This is the inn where you always set the bed by cutting the legs off or stretching them. Niches, okay. Niche, Munch, Strindberg, Schaben were part of a movement of artists and thinkers all proclaiming a similar message. The eminence of a superman, the emblematic importance of the sun, a man's will to power. I got. And then G. Gordon Liddy wrote The Will. And you just see this is brinking on the edge of madness, if I can say so. This is people with high thoughts, but if you give them a differential equation, they'd be stumped. Give them any maths. This is sort of thinking without maths, that's my view. Through in the mysticism of George Ivanovich Gurdjieff, a distorted interpretation of already dubious doctrine of survival of the fittest. This is complete insanity. This is really where people feed off science in madness. Wagner's notions about the outer reaches of art and philosophical tracks of Schopenhauer, and where was it all leading? Inevitably to the Nazis. But one must add some other ingredients, which is truly, it is leading to the Nazis, and then this is where the work of art I've seen, of the British one, where they add Ronald McDonald into it, it just is what is necessary. You need the Hamburglar added in on them. The second half of the 19th century saw the rise of spiritualism and occultism. Astrologers wrote of the Age of Aquarius, a notion that a new epoch would be inaugurated when the sun rose to Aquarius on the 21st of March. The year is less vague to herald Christ's second coming, or the Age of Aquarius. Then there was the Second Doctrine, 1888, by larger-than-life Madame Baralavsky, founder of the Theosophical Society, which made a deep impression in Germany and elsewhere in Europe. Her admirers included Mohandas Gandhi, Alfred Kinsley, Rudolf Steiner, Aleister Crowley, James Joyce, and William Butler Yeats, who described her as the most human person alive. So, my God, Kinsley is that Nazi person, is he? The Ukrainian aristocrat, adventurer, supposed the spy, undoubted occultist Helena Petrova Helin, as she was born in 1831-91, was married off at 17 to provincial senior governor of Florida. Stealing a horse, she rode over the mountain ranges back to her grandfather in Tbilisi. This is great. Within a week, she had married the skipper of an English tramp ship, taking cargo in Odessa, and embarked on a decade of travel. She smoked up to 200 cigarettes a day, ate like a horse, and swore like a trooper. While in Cairo in 1871, she formed a society for the occult. Her next port of call was New York, where she was reputed to have demonstrated physical and mental powers that included levitation, clairvoyance, clairaudience, out-of-body projection, telepathy, materialization produced by physical objects out of nothing. In 1875, she founded the Theosophical Society, a specimen of New Age thinking that bundled all religions into one, plagiarizing from each. She also had read Volney. She moved the society first to India, then to London, where she presided over a range of disciples. As a biographer wrote, the world debated furiously on whether she was a genius, consummate fraud, or simply a lunatic. An excellent case could have been made for either three. Isn't that great? Well, good God. So I'm going to say you're... And look, can I say that... we may well laugh, but these people are running amok in the education department. They are just amazing. Okay. In the sureness of oceans of space, she wrote, radiates the central, spiritual, invisible sun. Our inner beings emanate from the eternal central sun to be reabsorbed by at the end of time. And you can imagine how, with all these lunatics running around, the actual quantum physicist, which is slightly loony, it's just so hard to distinguish. The sun was the lens through which the spiritual light of the sun unseeable, i.e. God reaches our senses. Her theories were elaborated by the British writer Gerard Malsey, who attacked Christianity for turning the sun from a symbol of life to one of death. Another devotee, Alan Lau, moved the sun into the centre of the astrological interpretation, almost single-handedly reviving the most dubious activity after its sharp decline in the 17th century. The final ingredient in the cauldron is the Volschisch movement. Even before the advent of Nisch, Wagner and Wunsch, the northern and central German states were finally unified in 1871 after a flame pride in the ancient German archetype, as described by the Roman historian Tacitus in his great pioneering work of Ethnography Germanica. Personally, I associate myself with the opinions of those who hold that the peoples of Germany's there has been given a world, a race unmixed by intermarriage with other races, a peculiar people, that pure like no one but themselves, whence it comes to their physique, so far as can be said, with their vast numbers, is identical, fierce, blue-eyed, red-haired, tall frames, powerful. Oh, Tacitus. Really, I think, I really wonder whether racially Germany exists, or it has been a fiction, a Roman Empire fiction. There's also a Volk, glorified Tacitus' descriptions of their ancient woodland forebears who dwelt among the babbling brooks and picturesque mountains. And from 1870 on, the notion of Volk gained, unVolk gained currency. It was a white church. As Simon Stewart notes, it embraced Vondervogel, a youth movement, as well as the Ramblers, who communed secretly style around bonfires and forested hills, and also many who would later ardently support the Third Reich. But the onset was still fairly innocent. Volkshis enthusiasts included nudism, as we have seen in a form of sun worship, as extolled in the aptly named Heinrich Parler's Naked Mankind, A Leap into the Future, 1893, which also happened to be brazenly anti-Semitic Nietzsche. Look, and the entire thing is that I think I just can't describe the number of brochures, tourist brochures from London. This is up to the top floor of the Bailey Library. You go through it, and anti-Semitism, I don't think people understand how anti-Semitic the world was back then, and how racially and how mad the place is. Nietzsche was particularly close to the Volk tradition, which was treated which he treated with surprising respect. It was reciprocated, taking the inspiration cue from Nietzsche's publication "God is Dead," writes Richard Noll. The Volk created its own forms of personal religion. Occultism, the ideas of ancient theocracies, secret societies, and mystical apparatus of Rosicrucian, Kabbalism, and Freemasonry are woven in whatever worked. Now, it's Blavatsky. Baden Blavatsky. I think we have those people alive and well. The sun was about to be moved to the center stage. By 1890, many Volk people believed the sole god of the true Germans and began resurrecting pagan holidays to replace Christian holidays. Null notes. People, the most central neo-pagan element of the German Volkskirche movement, was sun worship, which extolled as a true ancient Teutonic religion. And while it was primarily a literary device and a powerful rhetorical metaphor for the experience of God, actual solar worship rituals did take place. After Germany's defeat in the First World War, a number of Volkisch movements were reorganized into propagandizing lands, and members became even more viciously chauvinistic. Volkisch thinkers began to contrast Germany as they saw it as a nation of heroes with Britain and Ireland of tradesmen, which epitomized the degeneracy of modern materialism. Hitler, who allied himself with the movement, the basic ideas of national socialist movements are populist, Volkisch, he wrote in Mein Kampf. also embraced solar imagery in the form of the swastika, which on the 7th of August 1970 was duly adopted as the emblem of the Nazi Party. So let's see. The swastika, which Sanskrit means Su, and Asti means to be, with the suffix ka, whatever that means. So the swastika, I don't know what ka means, but it means be good, has been in cultures around the world, excepting those of South Sahara and in Australia. Ancient people in the Indus Valley believed the sun to be square. Oh, sorry, I'm just stopping there. Go for it. Okay, the sun is square. And swastika as its symbol. Bent arms representing the solar wheel on its yearly course throughout the sky. Madame Blavatsky adopted it as part of his insignia of the Theosophical Society and a personal crest. She's a complete nutcase, isn't it? It's just amazing. In Ireland, farmers affixed swastikas called Brigid crosses to their doors. During the First World War, swastikas were sewn into the shoulder patches of American 45th Division even after the second could be found on the Finnish Air Force uniforms. All this society saw the right-handed clockwise swastika as an expression of life and good fortune. The left-handed swastika, on the other hand, represented Kali, a terrifying dark goddess of dark death, and also black magical significance. Nazis adopted both clockwise and anti-clockwise versions, although Hitler is said to have favoured the latter. Its popular Germany began in the 1870s, when the archaeologist Heinrich Schellmann found many swastikas in digs in ancient Troy and Marseille, and wrote about them in his two best-selling accounts of his discovery. Many anti-Semitic militaristic groups have started using the swastika by the time it became adopted by the National Socialists at Nuremberg in 1935. Usually termed the Hakenkreuz, or Thor's Hammer, it became an official emblem of the German Gymnast League, while the solar disk symbol began to appear on posters, armbands, banners, books and magazine covers throughout Central Europe. A German Jew buying toiletries in 1933 noted that even the toothpaste tube was so decorated. Oh, gee. Okay. Look, I must admit, I've read a bit of Zarathustra. Again, it is really the stuff of man Blavatsky, whatever the name is. Blavatsky. Okay. Once the Nazis were in power, they banned several traditional Christian holidays and substantially others to appropriate the new Germany. Southwest of Hanover stand an Extrasene rocks, also known as the Rocks of the Sun. Four weathered limestone pillars dating about 70 million years rise 100 feet atop by a Neolithic observatory whose round window lines up precisely with the dawn of summer solstice. Hitler, cherishing anything that might glorify the Teutonic race's ancient forebears, was enthusiastic about the place, and the SS promoted it as the old Germanic's most sacred sites, holding feasts, weddings, and Hitler Youth ceremonies where equinox and solstices. Wow, where's this? The Externstein rocks. And how many feet up are they? Yep, okay. I don't know why we don't know about this, people. So, Schopenhauer and Externstein rocks. All these beliefs required intellectual buttressing, and the National Socialists cast about for suitable candidates. The First World War, 150,000 copies of Thus Spoke Zarathustra had been printed for the Kaiser's army. The Nazis now distributed them to the Hitler Youth, and in 1934 laid a deluxe copy in the Tannenberg Memorial, which honored German soldiers who had fallen in the great victory there in 1914. To their delight, they discovered that the glories of natural paganism had also been propounded by Goethe himself, who just 11 days before he died had written, "I am asked whether it be my nature to give Christ adoring reverence and say completely, I bow before him as a divine revelation of the high principle of morality. And if you ask me whether it is my nature to worship the Son, I say again, completely, for it is likewise a revelation of the most high and to be sure the most powerful ever granted us mortals but to perceive." There's an asterisk here. So, my God, Father, this is... I had no idea of the Son's politics. Okay, while still a young man, Goethe decided that the greatest symbol of God was the Son, and set himself to perform a fire sacrifice whose flames must be kindled directly from the star. To make the ritual more fundamental, he chose not to use wood or coal, selecting instead incense sticks, because he said the gentle burning evaporating seemed much better to express what is happening to the mind than in an open flame. He then fastened some sticks to a small table, kindling them with a magnifying glass as soon as the sun appeared over the roofs of the neighbourhood houses. In his adoption, he failed to notice that the incense sticks had burned down to destroy the fine flowers planted on the family table. Bizarro, look, you could... just as nutty as a game. Not only Goethe and Nietzsche were at hand. From 1901, Carl Jung had expressed enthusiasm for Volscian ideas. His interest in them roused by the patient who believed the sun had a gigantic phallus that could control the weather. Jung noted similarities between the patient's delusions and pagan sun worship, and offer them as proofs of the existence of what he called collective unconsciousness. During 1909 and 1910, he became fascinated by the literature of Zoroastrianism and Mithraism and their roots in ancient Iranian solar worship, and developed a sun god theme, adding libido and hero, existing solar correspondence to light, father, god, and heat. Now, it's interesting about... the different gods, like the Holy Spirit being Apollo light, the version of light. It's pretty amazing. In 1912, Jung published Wunder Symbol der Libido, The Psychology of the Unconscious, which Dickel calls the Volkrich Liturgy, a modern mystical contribution to solar mythology of Bula. For in it, what should the great Swiss analyst do but resurrect the witnessing of solar faithful Max Müller, whose many books and articles would have been seen fit conveniently with Jung, his own preoccupation. And it's interesting because you have Jung asking it, you know, why do you do these things? Well, I have to, early on, in this book they say that Jung went, and so you can now see why Jung was asking about visited tribes of soul worship. Could now fit convenient with Jung's preoccupation. Is everything the dawn? Is everything the sun? Müller had pondered. My God, Father, just reading through this, the star and politics. Oh, it goes on. The questions I had asked myself many times before it was addressed to me by others, and here was Jung writing of exactly these concerns of the hero and the sun. God. The God as a self-immortalizing deity. Müller was resurrected to become the poster professor of the New Germany. So you can see how all this is, it's not Hitler, it's... it's amazing how this bred modern science, but it's also bred this... I think an overall experience, but a wide variety of things, and we've picked the good and the worst. I wouldn't be so judgmental of it. I mean, I suppose everyone has to judge the Nazis. In contrast, Rudolf Steiner, whose schools were shut down by the Nazis, referred to Jews as Dersonnevis, the sun beings, not a racist slur, but a personal philosophy, anthropophilosophy. He saw Christ as the ultimate sun being. Steiner's system, dating from 1913, was based on the premise that the soul can contact the spiritual world. The concepts of reincarnation and karma were central to it, as the concept of Christ was a cosmic force, a sun being who became incarnate and turning point of man's spiritual evolution. Wow. God. And you've got Steiner schools. Anthroposophy was condemned by the Catholic Church in 1919. So, isn't it amazing about the Steiner schools? Muller's writings presented the Nazis as much more than opportunity to build up a solar mythology because, of course, there was two prongs to his thought. The centrality of the sun in language and myth and the supreme place occupied by the Aryan civilization. He himself may never have been a racist, but he was a perfect advocate for the new dispensation, and his work on Aryan origins was soon being quoted to bolster Nazis' claim of a scientific basis for anti-Semitism. The appropriation of the sun manifested itself in several ways, but the most malevolent and far-fetched was the fantasy created by Heinrich Himmler, Reichsführer SS. It was he who spearheaded the quest for the ancestral heritage of pagan culture that has been suppressed by the Christian Church. It was he who embraced wholeheartedly the doctrine of the Black Sun. The Black Sun has recently been revived as a rallying point of the right-wing extremists. In Austria and Germany, a former SS, William Lange, who died in 97, appropriated the Black Sun symbol, swastikas and other images from Voltrish movement to become, by the late 1980s, a major political item in opposition to democracy and liberalisation of the West. The Schwarz Sun, which reaches back into ancient summer and Arcadia and holds the sun, manifests two powers, one white, the centre of our planetary system, the other black, hidden yet spiritually illuminating, the strongest and most invisible expression of God. This unseen, burnt-out sun, a source of mysterious energy capable of regenerating the Aryan race, had obvious affinities with the sun of Madame Blavatsky's theosophy. And it's really... I think we laugh at these people. In the 1970s, we had UFOs and this type of stuff. I just think it just takes a number of years to get through our Nazi phase, I hope. The secret doctrine was first published in Germany in 1901 to Jung's inner sun and to contrasting concepts of pneumon and phenomenon posited by Schopenhauer. I will have to re-release this. The term Schwarz sun was also to become a central element of the secret initiation of Hitler's senior SS generals. For the rank and file of the SS, about 50,000 men, the initials SS stood for Schulstaffel, meaning special staff of the military unit. But to the initiates, it reads Black Sun. Oh, that is incredible. That is just absolutely incredible. And the SS were only 50,000 people. I mean, that's a huge number of people, but compared to World War II, where you've got millions, there's just, like, there's no percentage of people in the SS whatsoever. Japan did not need insights into Jung and Goethe to see the sun's political possibilities. From the earliest times, its myth had rested... Oh, wow. Of course, they've got the rising sun, the warrior sun, and then you've also got Hitler, which is the swastika, the square sun, SS Schwarz sun. From the earliest times, its myths had rested on the foundation of the sun goddess Amitsu, divinity of its Tenno, or heavenly emperor, believed to be directly descended from the sun. Even as the sun is the centre of the universe, so the imperial dynasty is the centre of Japanese race life. Japanese flag, which has for over 1,000 years displayed the rising sun, affirms the nation's sense of solar ancestry, as does Shinto, the state religion. The outbreak of the Second World War, the solar energy became the nation's most visible symbol. Our soldiers departed to battle wearing the national flag tied diagonally across their chests, and headbands embraced them with the rising sun. Kamikaze pilots were similarly inspired by the God Emperor's bond with the sun. Gee, this is just, it goes on, but this is just the stark revelation. The links between the sun goddess, the emperor, and Japan's predatory ambitions in the 1930s was eloquently described by the famous American reporter John Gunther, who wrote just after the war, "The legend of the emperor's lineal descendant from the sun goddess and consequence divinity made the emperor sacrosanct and united the nations into a blinding, intense feeling not merely of loyalty but of actual kinship to the imperial house." Following Japan's surrender in 1945, the commander of the Allied occupying force, General Douglas MacArthur, set on demystifying the dynasty, told the Emperor Hiroshi that he must declare to his people that he is not a god. And this was not out of press, as Gunther comments. Think back. Before the war, a traffic cop gave the wrong signal in imperial possession. He killed himself in shame. A court tailor could not measure the emperor's clothes except at a distance because touching the emperor person was forbidden. When the emperor travelled, all blinds along the entire route were drawn because the theory to view the rich son of heaven might cause blindness. Well, there you go. Knowing there were many in the West who wanted to see him tried as war criminal, Horichi apparently submitted to MacArthur's demands. Historic reskip to promote national destiny, delivered on Newsday 1946. Longest living monarch in Japan's history, 1901-89, repudiated his defined status. Or did he? His statement, first made by the emperor to subjects since he commanded them to surrender the previous August, has never been easily available in Japanese. Originally drafted by the American occupation authorities, it was ingeniously added by Hirochichi's courtiers to appease their conquerors rather than to convey the meaning to the emperor's subjects. And while the West, Horichi's declaration was hailed as a momentous secession, a New York Times editorial said the announcement dealt a jungle religion to Shinto's a blow from which it can never recover. Even today, many Japanese are unaware that Horichi ever set aside his divinity. This statement, although known as Emperor's Declaration of Humanity, has never been discussed or analysed in Japan's national media. MacArthur's wanted the renunciation to emphasise the break with the pre-war system. For Horichi and his advisors, the object was to minimise the document's impact. The critical sentence is run. The ties between us and our people have always formed by mutual trust and affection. They do not depend on mere legends and myths, nor are they predicated by false concepts of emperor is defined. The Japanese people are superior to races and destined to rule the world. Wow. These words are printed on one occasion only in 1946, New Year's Day's newspapers. Unlike the emperor's earlier speech of 41 admitting defeat, they were never broadcast. Moreover, the whole statement is deliberately vague and equivocal, the subject of each of the clauses being not Horichi himself, but the ties between us and our people. The premise that the emperor is renouncing his divinity rests on a single noun qualifier, false. Further, to confuse the issue, the language was in archaic formal Japanese employed by imperial household. The phrase, the concept of the emperor is defined, is embodied in a single obscure word, atisukami, rendered by three characters, not ideographs, that even educated Japanese would not have recognized. When a near final version of the script was submitted to the Japanese cabinet in 30th December, a phonetic reading was written alongside the word so the ministers could grasp the reference. No wonder Horichi's advisors likened making sense of the directive's import to cutting smoke with scissors. In this context of words, it is empirical, the imperial myth that secretly triumphed. Horihito, who was allowed to retain three sacred items of sovereignty, the mirror, the curved jewel, and the sword, which together form proofs of his divine descent. The mirror? Wow. So the Muslims have the stone, the black stone, in the cube, and the Japanese have a bloke with a mirror, a curved jewel. Any effective pronunciation would have had these handed over to preparing powers, or at least a recognised museum. Defiant wind had blown again. By June, Horito was formally exonerated on charges of aggression and war crimes. Horito's similar struggle was the subject of the compelling 2005 film The Sun, produced by the Russian director Alexander Shulkov, as the third of a series about the downfall of the powerful leaders. In it, the 44-year-old emperor wanders around the virtual palace under virtual palace arrest, turning over in his mind how he will respond to MacArthur's ultimatum. "I'm no longer a god," he openly tells the manservants at one point. "I've renounced my divine nature." Then later he says, with conscious irony, "A deity in this imperfect world can speak only in Japanese. The sound engineer ordered to work on the radio broadcast commits harakiri. And Horikito, a Bethic chaplainist figure in the top hat and dress coat, ends by declaring, "The sun will go before the people completely in shadow." Since there is no actual broadcast, one wonders what the liberties have been taken. Not surprisingly, the film for ordinary session greeted its Japanese opening played to a standing room only audiences. Wow, that's just... I'm shocked by reading this. And this is what I really mean, that the average people don't go on intellectual. I'm not saying that I'm any better, but the people just don't read this type of stuff. So SS means Schwarzsam, Black Sun. In recent years, traditionalists have set about taking advantage of Horiru's sleight of hand. His son, the current emperor, Akito, born in 1933, is reported to have resumed the rituals of homage to the rising sun in the privacy of his palace grounds. Across the countries, conservative politicians have toiled to bring patriotism back into schools. The nationalist movement has enthusiastically promoted the imperial mystique. While offering the version of this country's past, it shows no remorse for the Second World War. The imperial family, said a former minister at a rally organising at Nippon Kaji, one of the country's largest national groups, is a precious treasure to the Japanese race, as well as a world treasure. Although historians trace the start of Japanese imperial system to the 4th and 5th century, according to the myth of the first emperor Jimmu, the son of Amaterasu began to reign 2,655 years ago. Politicians are now asserting this myth as fact, all the while promoting the corollary myth that the Japanese are an exceptional race, expressing the revisionist accounts of the country's wartime past. Japanese patriots wrote to Observer in autumn 2006, after the country had voted the national prime minister, sensing their sun is rising after decades of shame. Okay, there's a footnote here. It is often, in an often harshly male-dominated society, female voices occasionally brought the sun directly into politics. The writer-activist Hirokichi Rosho, the founder of the fledgling women's movement in Japan, sought to reclaim the sun as a feminist symbol. Her declaration that, in the earliest days of her history, the sun was a woman, became traditionally nationally famous. In her poem, The Hidden Sun, she dealt with this theme, insisting, originally, woman was the authentic person, but now woman is the moon. This, Boshi meant, in one time women defined themselves, but now they had allowed themselves to be defined by men. Asian women's struggle for liberation was the struggle to be the sun again. Okay. Over the last century, rulers of China have made full use of the symbolic authority of the sun. Mao Zedong became a full power in 1949, but as early as 1936, following the reign of terror in Yan'an, the destination of the 8,000 Long March, he was planning a personal cult which included associating himself with solar imagery. In 1940, Lin Shui, his original party vice chairman, referred to Mann's thought as being like the rays of the eastern sun. The chairman encouraged depictions of himself framed within the solar orb, and was consistently represented the sun that never sets. In 1960s, the imagery was showing up nationwide in songs, photographs, woodcuts, paintings, as well as such artifacts as teacups, money, swimming trunks. A typical graphic from the Cultural Revolution displays the red sun setting over a vast grain field, Mao as the source of prosperity. His famous Little Red Book, first published in 1964, with more than 90 million copies printed, shows him in a circle, golden rays spreading outwards, both a sun figure and a god. It's pretty amazing. The de facto anthem of the Cultural Revolution, the East is Red, lends its own special force to the identification of Mao with the party of the sun. The East is Red, the sun is rising, China has brought forth Mao Zedong. He amasses fortune for the people. Hurrah, he is the people's greatest savior. Chairman Mao loves the people. He gives our guide to build a new China. Hurrah, he leads us forth. Communist Party is like the sun. Whatever it shines, it is bright. Well, I think he's just got oodles of information here from the black SS being the black sun, Schopenhauer. And it's only a few more pages left. I think I'll be able to crash this through. The lyrics are attributed to one Li Yohan, a farmer of the northwestern Shaanxi. Throughout Mao's decades-long supremacy, they blazed over the PA systems in every city and village from dawn to dusk. God, the East is Red became the title of a song and dance epic promoting communism. While the film version was released in 1965, the song's title also became the name of a series of Chinese satellites, the first of which, the Dongfang Huang Man, included a transmitter broadcasting the famous look across the sun and a wicked planet. Because the anthem's association with the Cultural Revolution, it was rarely heard after the rise of Ji Bingsheng in the late 1970s. And today, it is viewed as an unsettling reminder of a cult of personality, so too with the visual representation of the great leader. With new modern China, it may be seem bizarre to look back on promotional films of radiating Mao, his image set against the blazing red background, with the rays shooting outwards like so many tracer bullets. But that was the everyday reality of hundreds of millions of Chinese for nearly 30 years. Of course, solar imagery has been employed by Chinese politics long before Mao. The activist artist Liu Hong, one of the leaders of Kuomintang, the revived China society, which became the National People's Party, designed two flags. The first showing the 12-ray sun against a blue sky. The latter, the United League, was well established. The red background was added and designed thereafter adopted as the flag of the Republic of China. Hong Dong became the first martyr of the People's Revolution when he was arrested by a Manchu government and tortured and put to death. Despite the political eclipse, the sun is in no danger of disappearing from the network of Chinese symbols, for it has long been part of the traditional medicine, neatly summed up in the statement, Chinese doctors believe the human body is built up, like all the universes, from yin and yang, etymologically dark, coiling clouds around bright sunshine. While written in the past sense, this describes tradition as alive and well in China today. Here's another footmark. In spring 2005, my daughter Mary spent several months before university working in the hospital of Shanghai, one of which she returned to the use of the old psychic physic. She showed me a book which had been recommended to her, Basic Theories of Traditional Chinese Medicine, which clearly explains which early on explains the original meaning of the concept of yin and yang is very simple. Initially, the terms referred to whether or not a place faced sunlight. The place that faced sunlight or that was filled with the sun is called the yang. The other place that faced away from the sun is called the yin. Methods based on the different are used side by side with modern westernized medicine. Well, there you go. It's not too far to the end. Not only leaders of state have sought to align themselves with the sun, many religions have adopted solar imageries, none more effectively through the millennia of the Roman Catholic Church. The year 2000 saw the publication of the book written by Pope John Paul II's most powerful aide, Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger, was to become Pope, who in 2004 became Pope Benedict XVI. Ratzinger made his reputation as the foremost theologian at the Second Vatican Council and wrote the Spiritual Liturgy while serving as a prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith, a position second only to popes in determining the Catholics must believe. In the course of his propagations of liturgy, which he considers to have been handed down by God, Ratzinger discusses a range of solar imageries in Christianity, its source, its meaning, its importance, and most significantly, its identification with Christ, which in his view is free of any pagan influences. This allows him to argue that, since Christ is represented by the sun, we find Christ in the symbol of the rising sun. We should change the direction in which we pray, even the orientation of our church's buildings, so the symbolism of the cross merges with that of the east. St. Peter's Basilica itself, because its topographical sentence faces west, but theologically this is a misfortune. He understands that the current theologians thinks the turning to the east towards the rising sun is something that nowadays we just cannot bring into the liturgy. Is this really the case? Are we not interested in the cosmos anymore? He argues the west must be and should be, should change our ways to face the east to pray. No wonder you'd get rid of him. My godfather is in that case. In the following chapter, Sacred Time, Ratzinger considers how the first day of the week was regarded as the day of the sun, and by the same cosmic symbolism, the sun proclaims Christ. He goes on, we have seen how deeply Christianity is marked with symbolism of the sun, which becomes the messenger of Christ. With each new year, the feasts of Christmas and Epiphany mark the dawning of new light and the true sun of history. He adds, with breathtaking genius, the complicated and somewhat disputed details of the development of these two feasts need not detain us from in this little book. The claim used to be made used to make that December 25th developed as opposition to the Mithrismas, or as a Christian response to the cult of unconquered sun promoted by the Roman emperors in the 3rd century in their efforts to establish a new imperial religion. However, these old theories can no longer be sustained, and for him, that assertion seems argument enough. He's a complete nutcase in terms of, yeah, you've got all these people arguing, and he just is complete featherweight. He just, oh, gee, he really believes in me. Yeah, I just think he had to go. The same confident rejection of any connection between pagan winter solstice and celebration of Christmas also applies to the observation of the resurrection and Easter in the time of the spring equinox. The close interweaving of incarnation and resurrection can be precise in relation to both proper and common, that each has to rhyme of the sun and symbolism. By chapter's end, the sun has become the image of Christ. Our old friend M. D. Voltney would have laughed, or more likely been enraged, had he read such sophistry, which is a kind word. It's called nutcases. But the old religion did not own the sun any more than those that followed him. It can be harnessed by anyone, and everyone will be. Politics of religion and state is no more than the art of government. And what better to call on for help, symbolic or otherwise, than the great star that governs us? All leaders, in their own fashion, will always find, will always land on the sun. Isn't that beautiful? And he's such a beautiful. He started off the bush landing on the sun. And he, Madame Batsky, what's her name? Madame, Blavatsky, Bla, that ski. Wow. So that's just, I was not expecting that to be so good. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.